Let's play a little word association game. If I said to you the word missionary, what comes to your mind? Nice and loud. You're also good. Let's pretend you're not you, and we go downtown Hopkinton. We've all got little roving mics, and we said the same question to you, Mr. Stranger. When you hear the word missionary, what do you think? What would they say?
A white man.
Anything else? How about the word evangelist?
Spreading
good news, okay. Is this what a person on the street would say?
No.
What a person in the street say?
Someone who shares? What religion are you?
Meaning what? Anything else?
A do-gooder.
Okay. Yeah, good. I think that's
right.
Someone who tells you what you should believe. Now we're getting in there. Anything else?
Maybe someone will cheat you out of your money.
Maybe somebody will cheat you out of your money. You're the evangelist. Yeah. Yeah, I wish I could give back to all the dear elderly Swedes I grew up with who were taken advantage by radio and television hucksters. I can't. Well, that's interesting. When we think of the word missionary or evangelist, we do think of somebody going out. I think it's really telling what Lewis says, a white man. This is just an aside now. If you were to name the country where most missionaries come from and have, say, for the last 30 years, do you know what country that would be? The country that has sent the most number of missionaries abroad outside their borders, do you know which country that would be? I can't hear. What country?
Utah.
Last time I came from Utah, they made me have a visa to get into Boston. To be a missionary, to be an evangelist, for most people in the culture is pretty negative. Now, I know that personally because, why? I was a missionary. And I was an evangelist. When most people think of missionaries and evangelists, including most Episcopalians, they think of somebody that is trying to ram something down their throat, somebody trying to pull a kind of theological fast one, somebody who really doesn't have my interests at heart but has their interests at heart, or has some idea of heaven that I ought to believe, and if I don't believe, I'm going to hell. That seems to be the dominant interpretation in our culture when we think about missionaries or evangelists. And there's good reason for that. We have been arrogant. We have been, I know it all. We have been spiritually superior. We have claimed to be the ones who have the answers. We claim to have God around, we wear God around our neck like a shawl. We know God and you don't. But if you want to know God, then listen to what I have to say and listen real carefully, because if you make a mistake, you're going to hell. Now, I regret to say that that's a fairly accurate picture of what evangelists and missionaries have been considered. Whether it's always a clear picture, I don't know. But I know it is a clear picture in some places. When I was overseas, I can tell you this. There were only two kinds of missionaries. The best people you'll ever want to meet in your life. And the worst. Both kinds I found on the so-called mission field. We are facing a crisis in our culture. A crisis of meaning, of significance, of purpose. People have lost that sense of meaning, significance, and purpose, and increasingly have laid it on material things. And so we need a new car. We need a new refrigerator. I say those two things because those are things that Christine and I think we need. We need them. It's not that we want them. We have this yearning sense that things aren't right until they all come together in a way that I have kind of conceived in my head. This loss of significance in our lives and in the lives of other people is robbing us of our heritage and even our identity. And if there's any time when the Episcopal Church and the Lutheran Church, since they're now calling us Luther-Palians, I don't know if you've heard that word, but they're trying to figure out what to say now, Lutherans and Episcopalians are doing everything together. That I used to say when I was in a Lutheran pulpit, do you want to see the Lutheran theology or Lutheran theory of evangelism? I say, yeah, what is it? You want to see it again? That is what we used to say. That's Luther-Palian evangelism. Big smile, big grin. Not much to say. Now, we're good at listening. That's the one good part. We're very good at listening. And I give these two churches a lot of credit for being able to listen to people who are very different from themselves. The problem is, what we need is dialogue. What's dialogue? Where we listen and we speak. And we listen so we have credibility when we speak. And when we speak honestly, it reflects back on our credibility. And the dialogue can grow. But for most people, most evangelical Christians, I dare say, dialogue is not what they're after. They're after conversions. Now, I have nothing wrong with conversion. I was an evangelist, and I practiced that method myself, looking for conversions. We have a lesson this morning that is somewhat troubling. I want to read. Unfortunately, the reading didn't include all of it, so I'm going to read a little bit more of the lesson that was not included. This is Paul. He has gone. Peter has just given this great sermon in Jerusalem, and everybody is cut to the quick by it and said, "Oh my goodness, how can we join?" And so, 20,000 people join. Now, one of the concerns that historians have across the world, world historians, is how did this little tiny movement in Jerusalem become a worldwide movement in such a relatively short period of time, 3 centuries? They go from being beaten and tortured and imprisoned and killed to basically running the Roman Empire. How did that happen? The expectation that most people have is, well, it was this powerful God that came swooping down and changing everybody's hearts. In the story that we read this morning, the first lesson, it tells us something very different. It gives us a picture of Paul not standing up and giving a great speech, but Paul going into the synagogues. He's a Jew, and he's going into the synagogues, and he's talking about what God has intended for all people and how good this is. And some of his fellow Jews accept the message, and others don't. But what I want to read to you is the fuller passage of the passage that Molly read. Paul in Athens. While Paul was waiting for some people to catch up and join him in Athens, he was deeply distressed to see that the city was full of idols. Now, I want you to remember that word, distressed. He was deeply distressed to see that the city was full of idols. So he argued, I want you to remember that too. So he argued in the synagogue with the Jews and the devout persons, and also in the marketplace every day with those who happened to be there. Also, some Epicurean and Stoic philosophers debated with him. And now that translation, because it's a translation from the original Greek, has dominated how we are to understand evangelism for 2,000 years. Now, I want us to go back and take those words, distressed, remember that, and argued, and change them because they're not the only translation from the Greek that is legitimate. So, another interpretation of the same words used more often goes like this. While Paul was waiting for them in Athens, he was moved, he was stirred to see that the city was full of idols. So he dialogued, he talked through in the synagogues with the Jews and the devout persons, and also in the marketplace every day with those who happened to be there. Do you hear the difference? One is, Paul was deeply distressed by seeing a town full of idols. The other translation, same word, in Greek, same word, says Paul was stirred, moved, deeply moved by seeing all the idols in the marketplace. Then the next thing, it says he argued. First he went to the synagogue, he argued with the Jews, then he went out to Areopagitic, and he argued with the Greek philosophers, the Greek and Roman philosophers. But the word argued, that's our English word, is not a very good translation. The word that's translated most often for this word, argued, is reasoned, including in this chapter. So another way of reading it is to say that Paul, deeply stirred by seeing all the idols in the marketplace and on the streets, was moved to dialogue with these people, the Epicureans and the Stoics, and the Jews. Now, you see the difference? If you think that your job is to browbeat everybody, to go get up on the hill, Mars Hill or the Areopagitica, and browbeat everybody to becoming a Christian, that's not what Paul does. Paul goes, and instead of arguing, he's dialoguing. The word is dialegomai. We talk through. So a dialogue is we have an issue and we talk it through. That is the Greek word. Now, why do the translators of the New Testament not use reasoned and not use stirred? I don't know. Except my guess is they know, Paul being a Jew, Jews are notoriously opposed to idols. Ancient Jews would go to their death and allow the death of their whole families before they would bow before an idol. It was that serious to them. And so if I'm a translator of the New Testament, I know that in my background, and so I might look at that word, dialegomai, and say, okay, he's pretty distressed. And so he's going to argue because he's distressed. Now that's my guess of what the interpreters were thinking. The problem with that understanding is that Paul is from where? He's from Tarsus. What is Tarsus? It's a Roman city. He saw idols all over the place his entire life. Getting to Athens, the text makes you believe that when he got to Athens, he's kind of surprised to see all these idols all around. He couldn't have been surprised. That was a common feature of his daily life in the city of Tarsus, where he grew up, where he was trained as a rabbi. And so for 2,000 years, we've had this notion that Christians are to go out and be horrified by what they see and do everything they can to kind of change people's minds. Instead of being motivated by love. I see, dear Athenians, I see everywhere I look the sense of religiosity that you have. It's wonderful. Let's talk more about it. What do you mean by the gods that we're all made from one family? What does that mean? And so Paul asks a series of questions that goes right to Epicurean and Stoic philosophy. And so they would understand and know his question and say, oh yeah, well, we get that. And Paul, motivated not by argument, and not by distress, but motivated by love, goes to the people and says, you know what? This wonderful religious impulse that you have is powerful. I want to tell you that we have an explanation for that religious impulse. You want to listen? You want to hear? We can talk about it. And so Paul does this. Now, we don't know what came of this event because Luke, the author of this story, all the stories in the book of Acts, Luke suddenly moves Paul onward. But here we have, in Paul, the earliest part of our New Testament, this idea that what we are to be as missionaries, as evangelists, is to go out into the world and love people. We are to love people. That means we are to look at their needs first before our need to have them on an evangelical scalp belt. That the motivation for us to go out into the world is love. This is the 500th anniversary of the Reformation, and we'll be hearing more about this all through the summer and into the fall, when our bishop will be coming on Reformation Sunday. Will be coming to St. Paul's, and that's very exciting for me. But I was reading this morning in the New York Review of Books a terrific article on Luther, and it drove home that everything that Luther said had to do with loving and serving the neighbor. More important than doctrine, more important than theology, more important than belonging to the right church. It's we are to love and serve our neighbor above all things. He must have known something. He must have learned something from Paul. May we also learn the same lesson. That all that we do in the world can be, should be, motivated by love. Amen.